Welcome to Building Fortunes Radio. Make sure you check us out at buildingfortunesradio.com. Along with our marketing partners, we're here to help our PM Marketing Network Lead customers build their businesses and make the world a better place. At Building Fortunes, we know how much your business means to you and the people important to you. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world. Now on to our show with your host, Peter Mingles.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us live on Building Fortunes Radio. That's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. For those people unfamiliar with my voice, my name is Peter Mingles. There's my voice still. And every once in a while, we get a chance to grab Scott Warren on one of our live radio shows. And tonight is one of those great events. Scott is a gentleman who's been a lawyer in the MLM world and other areas for a really, really long time. It's been over 20 years, I know. I met him as a result of some of the work that we were doing with the trade associations of this industry. I think I first met him, maybe got a chance to shake his hand when we were doing this stuff with the Distributor Rights Association or maybe even the MLMIA. But it's been a really, really, really long time, and I always welcomed Scott Warren on the legal panels that we had and any conference calls that we did because he was level-headed, explained everything in a very matter-of-fact, kind of very simple-to-understand way, and overall he's a really good guy. So he's a dad. He's got some boys in college now, like kids grow up and everything else like that. We've done radio shows before on his, I think it was his wife's birthday or maybe his birthday, where he's sneaking into the bedroom to be able to do our radio show as well. So he's a good sport, and he jumps on our radio show to be able to talk about some of the things that are happening in the industry. And this is our very first radio show of 2018, so I asked him to be on a little bit early. We usually do this on the first, the third, and if there's a fifth Monday of every month, but this one is the second Monday, but I wanted to be able to get some news out there relatively early in advance because there's some things happening. Besides being a partner in w-wlaw.com, so you would go to w-wlaw.com, he also recently inked a book, and that is called Schemes and Scams. And we did a radio show specifically on that, and he was really super nice to be able to send me a book as well on that, and I find it really very interesting. And it doesn't just talk about MLM. It talks about lots of different types of things, so you can kind of find the common ground relative to the different schemes and scams that are out there. And I just always like to say welcome to Scott Warren. So, Scott, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I bet you don't have any listeners tonight from Georgia or Alabama, since they're all watching football.
They could be watching football. That's true. They probably are. But they could be watching football and listen to us at the same time,
that's
I suppose.
True. Yeah.
They could be. Or they catch the replay. So for those people that
and
listen to
and by the
in,
way, your introduction,
yes, sir.
Your introduction about how long we've known each other and how long I've been doing this basically mm-hmm. just made me feel old.
I was thinking about that, too. I was thinking about that because, you know, we start thinking about old and, like, you have kids in college. Like, holy crap,
yep.
how the hell did you have kids in college? Yeah. It's like, oh, my gosh. Like, when did this happen? But,
exactly.
You know, we'll segue this in. Even though we get older, the stuff that we talk about is always sometimes the same thing, just a slightly
yep.
different story. And that's the
you
part
know what
that's
it is,
a shame.
Luke. It's the same basic scenario, just a new vehicle. That's all it is.
Yep. So for all those people listening in, I mean, we've been doing this for a really long time. And I know for me it's been 20 years in this industry, 12 years even before that in the direct sales world. You've been doing this stuff for most of your adult life.
25 years.
Yeah, so we've seen all of these things kind of go round and round, and they have these what I call PPs, the predictable patterns. Now, some of the drama may change, some of the actors may change, but they really do follow very predictable patterns. So if you listen into this radio show, you should not really be fooled, if you will, or scammed by some of these things that are out there. Or if you are, because sometimes even good people get scammed in different things based on some preliminary things. I'm going to talk about some of that as we go. But if you do, you're going to be less likely to be scammed, and hopefully you won't go all in like some of the people that we might reference on this radio show did. And now they've lost retirement accounts. They're losing you know, they have huge credit card bills. They've probably lost some stuff from other people's money as well. And they're in a real world of hurt. And sometimes it takes a decade, if not ever, to be able to recover from some of these things. So, Scott, I'll let you kind of kick it off if you wanted to talk about whatever we want to talk about on this one. Or why don't you tell people a little bit about the book first? So I don't want to drop – I don't want to get wrapped up in everything.
Just
tell people about the books.
I think you just did. I mean, that's basically it. I wrote the book as a collection of little vignettes of schemes, different schemes and scams that show that there's patterns. And to show that not only, I mean, it's, you know, somebody asked me if I was involved in each of them in some way. And I said, look, the first one that I wrote about is 300 BC. So no. But even since, you know, since the dawn of man, basically, the scams have been the same. And the pattern always seems to come out the same. So I thought if I could put a vignette together where little things change, you know, the actors change, the trust factor changes, the product, if you will, or lack thereof changes. But the basic premise behind it generally stays pretty much the same. And so if I could put enough examples together with twists and turns and a little bit of mystery and intrigue to some of them, that maybe people would spot that and avoid getting involved in them. So
yep.
That was the whole premise of the book.
And it's a great book. It's a great read, too. And one of the cool things is you don't have to read the whole book to get it. You can literally read a couple of pages and there's a story, and then a couple of other pages and read a story. So you can read it while you're at the bus stop, you know, at the train station, whenever you're doing anything, you know, grabbing a bite to eat. You can do any or all those things and get a nice little snippet and be able to go back to it. And there's not necessarily an order. Like, you could start wherever you start. Pick a topic that you like, and then you're not going to be missing out anything because you started in the middle. So it's a really great book. You can find it in lots of places, Amazon, of course, and then also I think you can find it. Scott, can they buy it on the website?
You can buy it on my website, and you can buy it actually in crypto on my website.
Cool.
So,
all right.
And then you can buy it on Amazon in regular paperback or in digital form.
So
and then I'm speaking this weekend at an event, and any of the events that I go to, people have them there. So,
excellent. Very good. So let's kick it off, and you mentioned the thing, cryptocurrency. You know,
yep.
There's this little expression, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. And in the MLM world, I playfully say, you know, the MLM slogan is, if it's too good to be true, you got to get in, you know, or you better get in.
You got to get in quick.
Yeah, you got to get in quick. So that's a golden rule, you know, kind of. But realistically speaking, there have been a lot of examples in cryptocurrency world where people did get in early. They were early adopters. They bought, you know, Bitcoin or any other kind of coin relatively early on. They talk about 100 times returns, 1,000 time returns, 10,000 time returns. And those are the Cinderella fairy tale stories, but they're real. That's the problem. Those kinds of stories that are real raise that level of doubt, and I think that's part of the confidence game that some of these scammers or scamming opportunities are taking advantage of people's ability to see that hint of trueness, although it's kind of weird. You got to kind of separate it out. So I'll let you kick it off, but I wanted to bring up cryptocurrency, if you will, combined with MLM, of any sort or any kind of an opportunity, and then let's talk about some of the recent things that might have happened with the USI Tech, which is a network marketing company, and also BitConnect. So if you want to kick it off there, I'll just kind of get you started.
Sure. Well, one of the things, you don't really have to even do the combination of crypto and MLM to get the same issues. Really what the regulators are looking at, unfortunately, or fortunately, however you look at it, with crypto, since there's been these ICO explosion, which is initial coin offerings, which are just like initial offering stock option or stock offerings, but they weren't regulated. So you could go out and raise as much money as you want on your coins that you've developed yourself that are not traded on the third-party market, you know, an exchange is what they're called, and you can set the price for them yourself. And then you manipulate the price yourself. And there were so many of these, in which most of them were fraudulent and scams, that the government said, well, we've got to start regulating this. So the government went back, and really they used a case from the 1940s that called the Howey case, which is a test. It's a four-factor test to determine if it's a security or not. And so you really don't have to combine the MLM aspect of it. They just looked at the crypto aspect of it and said, if it meets all four of these prongs, it's a security, and then it's either got to be registered or it's got to be exempt. Well, when they went through this and started doing this evaluation, what they found in the cases that they did, which were like Zen Miner Munchie, what they found was that they were lying to people, that they didn't have the hashing power, the computing power that they said they had, that they weren't giving the people what they promised them they were giving them. And they went after them. I'm involved with a company now that promised people that, and including myself, that they had 70,000 computers, which is what they sold. They showed them to us. Turns out they only had 24,000. So when they go after these people as a security, they're not even getting to the point of having to do a securities lawsuit. They're finding that they're actually Ponzi schemes. And, you know, the newest ones that you brought up, I mean, U.S. iTech was promising. It's a typical Ponzi argument. They promised a 1% return on investment per day. Anybody, I tell people this all the time, anybody that promises you a guaranteed return on investment is when you should stop and walk away, because it's a Ponzi scheme. No one can guarantee you a return on investment. You may get into some coin like a Bitcoin or a Ethereum or Litecoin that goes, you know, nuts, Ripple. But I personally bought Ripple at 2 cents. And I said, oh, great, it went to 40 cents and I sold it. I should have held on to it because it's now $3, I think. But those stories are out there. But those stories don't happen generally with the companies that control their own coin and it's not on an exchange. And they don't happen from a coin that gives you, a company that gives you a guaranteed return on investment, whether they're mining Bitcoin or any other coin or their own coin. If they guarantee you a return on investment, they are saying basically that we know it's going to go up 365% a year. Well, that's not realistic. And so then the question becomes, well, where are they getting it? Especially when in U.S. iTech's case, they said, they didn't even try to hide it. They said, your 1% return on investment is not tied to Bitcoin, whether it goes up or down. In other words, it's completely tied to us getting more investors. And so those kind of things that happen are very typical of Ponzi schemes and probably makes the SEC more emboldened to go after legitimate companies that are trying to do things right, because every time they go after one of these, it seems, they don't even have to go into the full evaluation. They just start, and all of a sudden it unravels right in front of their eyes, and it's a Ponzi scheme. So, I mean, that's where we're at with this whole thing.
There we go. So for those people that have never heard of the Howey test before, it's spelled H-O-W-E-Y. And a simple search engine search will give you the four-prong questions.
Oh, I'll give them to you.
Yep, there we go.
So
go ahead, and then
okay,
this way
I'll give them to you I'll give them to you in a non-technical sort of way without going in depth on them. But the first one is an investment of money. And generally, the first one is always it's always met, because generally you're buying something.
Even legitimate company, right? So even legitimate, an investment of money.
Right, but to meet the Howey test, you have to meet all four prongs. So pretty much everybody meets prong one. Prong two is a common enterprise, which means that it has to be a group of people together doing something, and that one's pretty complex because there's multiple ways that they look at it in different courts around the country. They have a horizontal method, a vertical method, and a strict vertical method. And all three of them are a little bit different, and they change the evaluation based on the jurisdiction. The third one is an expectation of profits. Now, this is a big one with crypto because the SEC's position is, why would anybody invest if they weren't thinking it's going to go up in value? My argument to that is the same argument I would make with gold, that there's a class of society out there that does not trust the fiat currencies of the world or the banking industry or the governments, and they're looking for a currency that they can use anywhere in the world that's going to be stable and that they can count on no matter what happens with governments. So my argument would be in many cases that the expectation of profits is not there with the people that are doing it. However, when you hear these companies talk, that's all they talk about is the promise of profits. So they kind of shoot themselves in the foot there. And then the fourth one is that it's solely from the efforts of the promoter or others, solely from the efforts of others. So if you do nothing to make the value go up, usually prong three and four, the expectation of profits is combined with solely for the efforts of others, solely from the efforts of others. Because if you invest your money, it's generally usually called a passive investment. If you invest your money with someone for it to go up in value and you do nothing, they do everything, that meets both prongs. So it's not a very hard test to meet all four prongs for. It's actually a harder test to be creative to make it so that you don't meet those prongs or to be, you know, set up right. It's
right.
Easy to meet all four prongs.
Right. So the thing with the Howey test is there are things in this world that all those four things happen when I buy Apple stock. You know, I'm not going to sit here and make Apple phones. You know, I don't do anything
that's
to
right.
promote Apple. But that's Apple stock. So there's lots of things that fit this Howey test, but they have to be what? They have to be registered as securities or registered. So go ahead.
Yeah, if you meet the Howey test, you either need to be registered as a security, which Apple stock is, or any publicly traded stock is registered with the SEC. Or you have to have an exemption. And one of the big arguments right now for companies is this sharing hashing power, which is what happened with these guys and with others. And if you're sharing hashing power and putting it all together, well, the reason you're sharing hashing power generally is because people can't afford the whole mining rig themselves. So they want to buy a partial mining. Well, if you're buying partial mining because you can't afford a full mining rig, you probably are not an accredited investor. And generally, the exemptions to the securities laws require people to be accredited investors, which means you have a certain net worth and certain sophistication in investments. So generally, the exemption part of it is probably not going to be a saving grace for companies that are doing MLM and crypto. The whole idea is you get in cheap. And the reason you get in cheap is because you're hoping to get a return on investment and without spending a lot because you don't have a lot.
Right. So the concept here, let's talk about, we'll use an example of a USI tech without using them specifically maybe, because a lot of them fall into this category. So there's the story about how you get started for a little bit of money, and then all of a sudden you're going to get this 1% return on investment. And I think in the case of USI tech, it was, you know, they give you back your money at 1% basically for the first 100 days, and then the next 40 days are going to be where you get your interest rate from. So they promise you a return on your investment of 140%. And then, of course, it always gets into the idea, well, you really don't want your money back. You want to reinvest. So you keep buying more packs, and then if you get people in, because you can help perpetuate the business, you're going to get a percentage commission on things along that line. And those are really the gray areas or the blatantly bad areas where people get themselves in trouble. In reference to this, though, they seem to really catch fire, meaning those things usually seem to go like crazy for a while, and everybody makes money, and everybody means everybody. Everybody makes money because of that passive element, and then all of a sudden, they don't anymore. So what is it about the nature of this Ponzi element that causes everybody to make money, and then all of a sudden, they don't anymore? And that's part of the challenge, too. Because everywhere you look, this guy's making money, this guy's making money, you're making money, at least on paper or in digital forms in your back office. And then they don't anymore. Why don't they anymore? What is the magical thing that triggers the end?
Well, once less people start coming in, the money dries up and they can't pay out the commissions, and therefore they're figuring, and if the crypto that they're investing in goes down at all, then they're doomed, because what they're doing is they're subsidizing their portion from their portion of profits. They're subsidizing, if it goes down, the losses. But if it stays stagnant, they're okay. If it goes down a little, they're probably okay. If it goes down a lot or it stays stagnant for any number of days, there's no profit there for the company, and people aren't as enthused about joining because they're all looking at the exchanges and seeing the numbers go up. And if they're not enthused, less people come in, less packages are purchased, and all of a sudden there's not enough money to pay out what was promised.
Right. So usually it gets big enough where they can't hold their breath, if you will, for very long. So if there's a disruption in the technology, if there's some kind of a legitimate problem like a hack or some kind of a problem with a bank or a vendor or something else, or if there's a slowdown in recruits like you had mentioned, or maybe some of the challenges associated with maybe a government agency like the SEC, then all of a sudden they can't survive for very long. They go down quick because of the massive amount of people they have to pay out. Let's talk a little bit about, if you will, the recent actions of the security exchange. So what does the SEC do?
Well, the SEC can do any number of things. But first, let me comment on what you just said a second ago. Two of the examples you used were, if I can remember now, I can't remember what I had for dinner a half an hour ago, so bear with me. No, you said
technology glitches.
Oh, hacking, or banking issues. Generally, those are not real. In most cases, when they start saying, hey, we can't pay out because we were hacked, or we can't pay out because we have a banking issue, that's generally not true. In most cases, it's made up by the company, and it's because they couldn't pay out, and so they're making excuses, and that's the beginning of the end, generally. But back to the SEC.
And then what happens is the run on the money. Anybody that can get their money out then does.
Gets it out quick.
And then it's over.
Yep.
Then it's over.
Which
is the same reason.
It's
the same reason why banks don't allow you to take out all your money at one time. Or if there was
a run
on the money, the banks would shut down. And, we could talk about that. And that's one of the reasons why there's cryptocurrencies. Because people are afraid of, if there's ever any kind of a problem with the banking industry, there'd be a run on the money. Or just like what happened with the financial collapse.
That's one reason. Another reason is people don't want to pay their taxes. And since crypto has anonymity in most cases, and it's not liquid, it's not even considered a currency. It's considered property, so it's not really valued until you sell it, that people think they can avoid their taxes, which, is likely from one country to another even. Is likely tax evasion. So that's why
we haven't even seen
getting,
that bubble. Yeah, we haven't even seen that bubble yet.
But that's why governments are getting so involved. All the governments are becoming more aggressive on it and putting out statements anti-crypto. It's not because they're against crypto. In fact, most of these countries want to start their own cryptocurrency, including our own. But it's because they're not getting their piece. And the government wants its piece of the action. And so if everybody was honest and paid their taxes based on what they did, the government would be fine with crypto. But since people don't, they're not fine with it. But anyway, back to your SEC question. What does the SEC do? The SEC can do any number of things. They can do an inquiry. They can subpoena records and just question people. They can issue a cease and desist. Most of the time that's state level, not federal, which just means stop what you're doing, we're investigating. Usually the cease and desist is the first step before a lawsuit or an investigation. And an investigation, you know, nothing may come out of it, but something comes out of it even when nothing does, because there could be nothing done wrong, but it certainly is disruptive to the company and scares off a lot of potential distributors or members or investors or whatever they are in whatever the case is. So the just the power of investigation is frightening enough to most people in the business. They can come in immediately and shut you down, seize assets. Their powers are daunting, frankly. They don't really answer to anybody. And they have unlimited subpoena power where they can demand your records, demand everything without ever filing a lawsuit against you. So, you know, there's an old saying that the bureaucracy must get bigger and bigger to feed the ever-expanding bureaucracy. That's what it is. So,
right. So now what the SEC can't do is the SEC can't arrest you, right? I think that has to be done by somebody else.
Does not have a policing ability. They use the Department of Justice for that, and they use the FBI as their investigative agency.
So the thing is, like, the first blow, if you will, would be a cease and desist from the SEC. That's kind of like a test of, okay, you got 30 days to answer this, and you're on notice. And
yeah, with the SEC, a cease and desist is not the first step. The first step from the SEC is generally an investigation, which would be subpoenas for records or subpoenas for documents. And then after their investigation, if they find nothing or if you're cooperative and clean, then the next step is basically you sign some consent decree with a slap on the wrist and you pay them a small fine and you move along. If they do find stuff, and since they're basically cops and they're looking to find stuff and they believe that you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent, it's an absolute opposite of the standards of the Constitution. You are guilty until you prove yourself innocent in the eyes of the SEC or the FTC or any of those agencies, because they're bureaucrats. Again, they don't answer to anybody. They weren't elected. They don't have to worry about losing their jobs or funding or anything like that. So the first step is usually an investigation, a subpoena, and it usually drags on. It's usually month after month before anything happens. If they see something particularly egregious, like in the case of US iTech with the Texas Securities and Exchange Commission, it's a state agency, not a federal agency. The state of Texas Securities Commission gave them a cease and desist letter, which is immediate. It's not you've got 30 days to stop doing this. It's stop now, because we know there's something egregious here and people are being hurt. That's generally that's where you get into, you know, something after that, something big is coming. There's going to be a lawsuit. There's probably a referral out to the Department of Justice for criminal prosecution or something like that when it's egregious. But generally with the federal SEC, you can tell when it's very egregious, because they'll slap you with an immediate cease and desist. They'll have U.S. Marshals come in, seize assets. With a typical SEC matter, there's subpoenas issued, and there's an investigation that's somewhat time-consuming.
So in essence, what happened with US iTech, although we don't know all the details, is they were obviously in a world of hurt based on this temporary or this cease and desist. And they decided, the company decided, that they were going to shut down US and Canada operations. So for whatever reason, we're not there, so we don't know why, but they decided that they were going to do that. And that meant that there's a lot of distributors that are now wondering if they're ever going to get paid. They've already been told that you have to kind of scrub the internet and scrub everything, you know, basically like you never existed. So I would consider that almost like hiding the evidence. So
absolutely,
that was part of the
thing. And it's against, by the way, that's completely against the cease and desist order. You
mm-hmm.
are supposed to, you are required to preserve everything and not delete anything. So, and they, I know you, everybody out there is saying they decided on their own to shut down Canada and the U.S. That's a misnomer. They were served with an immediate emergency cease and desist order from the government, which basically said you are shut down. And then the next day, Canada issued the same thing. So they were shut down by those two. They didn't have a choice. I mean, this was not a, hey, will you please cease and desist while we investigate and not build anymore. This was a emergency cease and desist letter to a judge saying they are out there harming the public and they need to be stopped immediately. So they were given no choice as to whether to shut down or not.
The way they phrase it in their letters, which, by the way, is publicly available, it was like we're shutting down the United and Canada, and then we need you to scrub the internet and scrub everything so you never existed because you've now been terminated, so you don't work for us anymore. And they also said we're going to consider paying you on some of the things that we owe you, but we've got to do some preliminary investigation to be able to find the offenders, and we might actually go after some of the offenders or hold their pay or not pay them, and we'll know in a couple of weeks. Which to
me, what I find disgusting about the whole thing is that the letter that they put out, their statement that they put out, instead of taking responsibility for what they did, blamed it on the distributors.
Correct.
Which is complete nonsense. It's just, I mean, seeing that is really sickening.
Now, I have a question because as I've been looking through some of the things related to, you know, how did they get this far? How did so many people get sucked into this? There were some times where I saw, I think it was the owner of the company, actually on stage with a microphone saying, we've hired the legal minds of previous SEC people in a law firm, and they found us to be completely compliant in the United States. So we have been approved to do business in the United States. So when regular people, even smart people, business people, hear the owner of the company singing the praises of a law office that they hired that gave them either legal opinion or come to some conclusion that they are legal in every jurisdiction, in every country that these people are in, that throws a conflict in the mind of the credibility. You just say to yourself, wait a minute, the company said that there was a lawyer behind it. And the company said there's a legal firm behind it, so it must be valid, or it must be okay. They must be whatever. So what are your thoughts about when those things happen and people are looking to do their due diligence or do some kind of homework?
Kind of twofold. One, the law in this area is really evolving in front of our eyes. I mean, it's the same thing that people thought was going to be the law even 3 weeks ago isn't where the SEC's at with it now. I had a meeting with the SEC a few weeks ago and brought up an issue with them, and they said their response was, oh, sure, that's our public position, but our private position is different. Well, that's not fair to consumers or to any company even. If you're going to come out with a public statement of what your position is on something, and yet in private you believe something else and now you're going to prosecute people based on that, that's not fair. So that part of it's wrong from that standpoint. But the SEC did put out a statement a month ago saying that we will be looking at taking action against accountants and brokers and attorneys for giving bad advice to companies, thus getting people involved in something that is a security that's unlicensed. I think a lot of it with the government is, as far as people getting ripped off and prosecuted and things like that, is the intent of the company. When they look at these companies and they see, you know, it's a first of its kind, let's say, you know, and they say, okay, well, we didn't really, the law wasn't clear, give me a slap on the wrist, everybody go along with your business, just tweak, fix things. Versus when they start, when they do an initial investigation into one of these deals, and the example that I gave earlier, that 70,000 computers were sold, and there's only 24,000 in existence. When they see that, it's the gloves come off, and they say, forget the securities aspects of this. This is a Ponzi scheme. And once they do that, then everybody's ripped off. And most of the time, the brokers, the attorneys, the accountants, everybody is blindsided because they didn't know this was happening. You look at documents when you're in that position, and you look at, you know, what you're being told by the company and what documents you see and things like that, and you don't know if they're actually doing that in practice or if they're cooking the books. So most of the time, I wouldn't pay much credence to it, I guess. I think that you have to do your own due diligence and independently. And, you know, I tell people on every investment, every, not just crypto, if you can't afford to lose it, don't do it.
Right. So as a golden rule or as a guideline, you don't even need to know most of the things that we said on this conversation. As soon as people start talking about a return on investment, you should be thinking to yourself, now tell me if I'm wrong, and I'll say, okay, I guess I'm wrong about this. But anytime people start talking about a return on the investment, you should immediately think that this is might be an investment contract, a security, and they need to be registered. Would that be a safe enough assumption? Like,
that's a good starting point, yeah.
Almost every time.
That's a very good starting point.
If it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, seems like it's always like a duck, and they're not registered, and they're big, and they're not registered with the SEC, I would say run like hell, because not only can you lose your money,